My name is Michael McCusker. Up on the board here in the studio of Doom is a little note which says, R.I.P. Vern Barth, Jazz Guru, Memorial 1013, which is October 13th, 4 p.m., Moose Lodge, Astoria. And I would very much like to dedicate my program today to DeVern, who just died the past week, I believe it's been. He was an incredible fellow. And although we certainly didn't always agree on things, I considered him one of the best friends I've had in a long time. He was a damn fine man. And I'd like to read an article from a book written by another friend of mine who, so far as I know, is still on this side of the dirt, even though he turned 71 this last August, 2 days before I did, David Horowitz, who taught history for many, many years at Portland State University, and I believe he is or should be Professor Emeritus. And this is from a book he wrote, America's Political Class Under Fire, The 20th Century's Great Culture War, which was published a few years back by Routledge Press, and which I ran in my newspaper, the North Coast Times Eagle, a few years back. The Political Class and American Democracy by David A. Horowitz. It covers some real depths of the American political process that worry many of us, and especially their contradictions. Politics and governmental affairs were of limited salience, and that's a quote, to many Americans, wrote political scientist Stephen C. Craig in 1993, because the public believed it no longer could control or direct the system. Craig's pessimism was echoed by Clinton pollster Stanley Greenberg, who described a dispirited, alienated, and fragmented citizenry in an environment which nobody seems to be in charge, nobody can be trusted to do what they say, and nobody is in position to see the country through, quote, unquote. By the last decade of the 20th century, social critics and social commentators like Christopher Lash and Kevin Phillips were suggesting that the dysfunctional political system reflected the division of American society into two distinct and antagonistic factions. Beyond the reach of ordinary citizens and removed from the physical demands of the productive economy, a subculture of administrators, social service professionals, and academic consultants set public discourse and advised government leaders. Comprising a key element of a nationwide guardian class, and that's also in quotes, knowledge specialists and interest group advocates thrived upon an enhanced public sector. A progressive, rights-oriented philosophy and emancipatory cultural ideals further distanced the group from the majority of Americans. Lash believed that conflict between the two groups amounted to a form of class warfare in national life. The heart of every complaint I hear about our government today, amateur politician Jesse Ventura observed in 1999, was the conviction that the political system was controlled by comfortably ensconced people who are many levels removed from the working people of this country. Convinced that the political class devoted too much energy to keeping itself in business, Ventura won an independent race for Minnesota's governorship in 1998 on the Reform Party ticket. 2 years later, Republican Senator John McCain of Arizona attracted the support of independents in an unsuccessful but widely publicized run for his party's presidential nomination that called for sweeping campaign finance reform and attacked special political interests. Meanwhile, fellow Republican George W. Bush, son of the former president, squeezed out a bitterly contested Electoral College victory over Democrat Al Gore by insisting on less government and more trustworthy leaders. Once Islamic terrorists mounted deadly suicide attacks on New York City and the Pentagon in 2001, Bush dedicated his presidency to the protection of citizens through increased homeland security and the deployment of U.S. military force in Afghanistan and Iraq. Ventura, McCain, and Bush each played upon suspicion of the Guardians, who comprised the nation's governing elites, social policy consultants, and opinion molders. The sentiments expressed by these political figures had an extended history. Hostility to the socially committed knowledge and professional sector first had erupted in Wisconsin, the laboratory of progressive reform, and the state where university specialists initially assisted in the formation of public policy. During the 1920s, contention over the societal role of intellectuals helped to engender bitter debates between modern secularists and moral traditionalists. Both the Leopold Loeb case and the Scopes monkey trial provided ample grounds for discussing the place of scientific and cultural experts in defining society's mores. Discomfort over rapid social change and the perceived influence of intellectual elites helped to shape the impassioned rhetoric of the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, whose leaders ostracized liberal opinion leaders as strangers to the American way. Impacted by enormous demands of the Great Depression, President Franklin Roosevelt turned to a brains trust of academic and legal advisors after 1932, which is the year he was elected. Yet by appearing to bypass the cumbersome legislative process and by concentrating policymaking in the White House, Roosevelt left his administration vulnerable to charges of undemocratic procedures. Criticism was particularly strong from representatives of small agriculture and independent business who sensed that the president's experts were ignorant of their problems, apathetic about their interests, and hostile to their needs. Anxiety over the role of executive branch consultants led to overstated charges of White House complicity to anti-capitalist conspiracies or other attempts to redesign and restructure the political system. Nevertheless, suspicions about the use of applied intelligence continued to complicate the Roosevelt administration's attempts to induce economic recovery and stabilize the country's institutions. Once Roosevelt won re-election in a 1936 campaign in which the Brains Trust was a major issue, concerns over executive branch advisors and bureaucratic administrators contributed to a series of political crises that seriously marred the president's second term. Congress resisted White House reorganization, criticized the consumerist bias of Roosevelt economists, objected to the dominance of anti-business attorneys affiliated with the National Labor Relations Board, demanded limits on the arbitrary power of executive agencies, worked to reduce the number of professional staffers in government bureaus, and sought to limit social experimentation in recovery programs like the Civilian Conservation Corps. Some critics of the New Deal went so far as to depict Washington's emerging political class as a haven for radical Jews. The coming of World War II and the menace of foreign totalitarianism intensified concerns over the evolution of a permanent bureaucracy in Washington. Threatened by the executive branch's growing power, Congress mounted highly publicized investigations into the influence of academic and professional experts on domestic federal spending, social programs in the civil defense agencies, stateside propaganda activities, government price fixing, and long-range economic and social welfare planning. Concern over the preservation of traditional economic virtues, democratic principles, and their own political power led congressional leaders like Martin Dies Jr. to undertake inquiries into the alleged radicalism of a number of academics employed by the Roosevelt administration. By 1945, a majority in Congress had rejected the New Deal's flirtation with collectivist social experiment and high-minded reform. With the onset of the Cold War, the philosophy and behavior of government managers, policy experts, and academic consultants came under increasing suspicion. Critics associated the intelligentsia with a communist movement that supposedly functioned as a strategic interest group for power-hungry knowledge elites impatient with democratic procedure. The post-war controversy over political intellectuals emerged full-blown with questions concerning the character of New Deal manager David E. Lilienthal. A series of congressional inquiries into the alleged threat of communist subversion intensified the growing chasm between new class insiders and traditional power brokers in local politics and business. Distrust of cosmopolitan elites also shaped the House Un-American Activities Committee's investigations into the past conduct of the Hollywood Ten and Alger Hiss. Accusing President Harry Truman's State Department officials, high-ranking military officers, and foreign advisors of insufficient awareness of the Cold War's moral implications, Wisconsin Senator Joseph McCarthy mounted a populist attack on the administration's alleged toleration of domestic communists. McCarthy's portrait of arrogant, privileged, and unaccountable political academics received support when lengthy hearings by the McCarran Committee led it to denounce the scholarly Owen D. Lattimore as a conscious instrument of the communist conspiracy. The debate over the security clearance of physicist and nuclear weapons consultant J. Robert Oppenheimer reintroduced doubts concerning the loyalty of intellectual elites to core national values during the Eisenhower era. Yet Republican occupation of the White House led to the demise of Joe McCarthy when the Wisconsin senator turned against the military establishment in the televised Army-McCarthy hearings. Meanwhile, congressional Republicans led an investigation into the alleged role of tax-exempt foundations and social science, researching and formulating collectivist government policies and influencing public education and social attitudes. In a period in which anti-communism appeared to incorporate deeply held anxieties over the intrusion of remote elites into daily existence, a series of grassroots campaigns focused on the unseen dangers of fluoridated municipal water supplies, which, incidentally, Portland has finally voted to approve. The Cold War emphasized the extent to which the American public entertained profound suspicions concerning the cultural ideology of socio-political professionals and policymakers. The Civil Rights Revolution of the 1960s shifted the grounds of such concern. By involving white professionals, intellectuals, and social activists as strategic allies, the crusade for racial justice intensified anxieties over the role of federal administrators and regulators in using state coercion to erase human distinctions. Threats of depersonalization and powerlessness became a major focus of George C. Wallace's presidential primary campaign of 1964. In the general election, Republican Barry Goldwater charged that forgotten and silent Americans had been eclipsed by powerful social interest groups aligned to Lyndon B. Johnson's Great Society. Johnson's war on poverty elicited fears among local politicians that administrators were building their own power bases in local communities by colonizing the poor and selecting favored clients for lucrative patronage awards. Accusing the Great Society of double standards of racial justice, Governors Ronald Reagan and George Wallace tied a culturally permissive liberal elite to the social disruptions, crime, and street violence of the 1960s underclass. Such themes became the focal point for Richard M. Nixon's campaign for the presidency in 1968. Despite Nixon's coolness to social programs, the new administration endorsed a controversial affirmative action plan in the construction industry, bitterly opposed by organized labor. Yet the Republican president also courted working-class support for the Vietnam War and opposition to would-be members of the professional classes in the Student New Left and peace movement. Expropriating themes from Goldwater, Reagan, and Wallace, the Nixon White House denounced campus dissidents as a radical elite whose cultural values defied basic decency and common sense. Nixon's hatred for perceived allies of the anti-war movement contributed to his fatal involvement in Watergate-related attacks on the liberal establishment. When Jimmy Carter wrote a reform tied to the presidency in 1976, opponents effectively fused condemnations of special interests and opposition to progressive social values into a creed of populist conservatism that helped bring the Carter administration to its political knees. During the 1980s, Republican presidents Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush built powerful electoral coalitions on the demonization of big government and on public impatience with the nation's new class guardians and political interventionists. Once Bill Clinton won the White House, he and his wife Hillary became the target of critics who saw post-war World War II baby boomers as politically unreliable and tainted by cultural deviance. Although Clinton's affirmative action policies and interventionist health care proposals strengthened such sentiment, America's controversy with the guardian class appeared to peak at century's end with the culturally infused debate over the White House sex scandal and the subsequent impeachment of the president. Originating in a variety of ideological perspectives across the 20th century, the response to America's political class and social guardians has contained enormous contradictions. During the 1920s, the Ku Klux Klan and other social conservatives charged that academic intellectuals were exerting an excessively liberal influence over the nation's cultural agenda and social morality. Yet Republican populists from rural states simultaneously denounced scholarly specialists who used their expertise to deliver pro-Wall Street testimony before congressional committees. When the Great Depression led to Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal, the Democratic White House relied on market-oriented economic advisors who sought to restore consumer prosperity through federal expenditures, reinvigoration of credit, social welfare programs, and legislation support of workers and organized labor. Yet the statist implications to Roosevelt's programs and the administration's alliance with the unions led modernizing intellectuals like H.L. Mencken and Walter Lippmann to join producer, critics, and others in condemning the New Deal as inordinately radical, even socialist. Another paradox emerged when Republican adversaries of the Roosevelt administration refashioned populist rhetoric to suit small business and farming interests during World War II, going so far as to argue that consumer-oriented programs like price controls were elitist. The contradictory response to the guardian class took dramatic form during the Cold War when anti-collectivist ideologues alleged that key governmental and cultural figures aspired to build an international communist worker state that would elevate intellectuals as a powerful elite. Although assertions over the foreign ties of the political intelligentsia were exaggerated, anxieties over the suspect orientation of policy intellectuals and knowledge professionals resonated deeply with the public. Such concerns resurfaced in the 1960s controversy over federal sponsorship of civil rights. When the quest for racial justice resulted in coercive government mandates such as affirmative action, civil liberties crusaders such as Sam Ervin and Paul Fanon viewed Washington bureaucrats as the problem. The paradoxical nature of race politics emerged when the Nixon administration compensated for an affirmative action alliance with social interventionists by courting organized labor, the former ally of 1930s political intellectuals, and called for moral unity in the Vietnam War against the cultural dissidents of the upper middle class. Ronald Reagan and George H.W. Bush further complicated the political landscape by expropriating the critiques of corporate-funded theorists to espouse a populist conservatism that marginalized rival policy administrators and social specialists as physically irresponsible and morally decadent. In an added irony, Bill Clinton sought to avoid the dangers of tax-and-spend liberalism by proposing a health care package that substituted government regulation of the private insurance market for huge Treasury expenditures. Yet distrust of political intellectuals and interventionist policies was so great, the Clinton plan suffered a humiliating defeat. Positioning himself as a centrist, the Democratic president nevertheless had to contend with pervasive discomfort with the dissident politics and culture of the 1960s, of which he remained an unlikely but cogent symbol. Perhaps the greatest contradiction of the century-long campaign against America's political class has been the futility of much of its effort. Critics of social guardians found themselves opposing a host of decent and plausible causes, including scientific teaching in the public schools, improved working conditions for industrial labor, regulation of the stock market and public utilities, cooperative experiments by federal youth agencies, consumer price controls during wartime, assurance of intellectual freedom for academics and foundation-sponsored researchers, adoption of benign public health measures, enactment of civil rights gains and anti-bias laws, protection of programs to aid the poor, and inclusive efforts to spread equality of opportunity. Furthermore, dangerous portions of anti-intellectual discourse embraced unwarranted hyperbole, unreasoned argument, banal half-truths, crude exaggerations, narrow-minded prejudice, and inelegant conspirational thinking. Indeed, the frequent failure of those opposing the guardian class cannot be separated from the cruel excesses associated with such individuals as Father Charles Conklin, Joseph McCarthy, and George Wallace, and such phenomena as the Scopes Trial, the 1920s Ku Klux Klan, Depression-era anti-Semitism, anti-fluoridation paranoia, race supremacy ideology, the Vietnam War, Watergate, and the rejectionism of the late century extreme right. Even when opponents of the intelligentsia discredited their causes with bigotry, bullying, terror, or outright violence, however, challenges to America's 20th century guardians often touched on central social anxieties. The leading focus of such efforts appeared to be the perceived erosion of fundamental values related to individual autonomy, personal empowerment, family cohesion, religious devotion, community bonding, ethnic allegiance, and national loyalty. Often representing traditional producers and members of the old middle class, critics of the political intelligentsia denounced a social agenda that allegedly encouraged the erasure of human distinctions and the obliteration of cultural differences. They warned that the coercive and manipulative methods of the intellectual classes threatened ordinary citizens with mass depersonalization, powerlessness, and the eradication of vitality and meaning from democratic political life. Concerns of this nature help to explain why professional elites and knowledge experts repeatedly have been attacked as agents of modern social and cultural degradation. For nearly 100 years, public discourse in the United States has been marked by a continuing dispute over a broadly defined political class whose members have been castigated as strangers to the American way. The stranger represented a cultural renegade, a shadowy suspect who assumed a powerful inside position and threatened to use the coercions of social authority and expertise to impose abstract creeds, whether they be statist, collectivist, internationalist, or multiculturalist. When socially involved intellectuals embraced admirable causes such as freedom of inquiry, support for organized labor, civil rights for racial minorities, or anti-militarism, their participation, alleged motives, and presumed interests often became the central target of ideological strife and intergroup conflict. Yet their adversaries have been frustrated by the perception that social interventionists and members of the political class often manage to overcome their detractors and perpetuate and expand the bureaucratic networks and careers associated with their ideology and rule. It may be difficult to ascertain whether service professionals, policy planners, and socially oriented intellectuals constitute members of a new class that monopolizes governance and opinion in modern society. Yet the troubled response to the interventionist intelligentsia in 20th century America illustrates the warning of one scholar that, quote, knowledge and expertise are inherently suspect when they become a basis for claims of political influence. Bureaucrats, planners, experts, and social service professionals often have compounded the vulnerabilities of their position with condescending attitudes toward the people they were mandated to serve. As sociologist Alvin Goldner noted, upper middle class practitioners tend to assume the world should be governed by people such as themselves. Quote, those possessing superior competence, wisdom, and science. Similar concerns mark the criticism of Christopher Lash, who condemned the insularity of educated professionals and who questioned the tendency of experts and knowledge elites to equate dissent from their self-serving agenda with emotional and cultural backwardness. Given the legitimacy of such objections and the pointed quality of much of the protest, it nevertheless must be acknowledged that no civilization can thrive without affording an important role for educated experts, knowledge professionals, socially oriented intellectuals, public administrators, and human service practitioners. Certainly, if society is to accomplish more than assuring personal profit for the wealth and defending vested economic interests, and I should have said profit for the wealthy, it must be open to sources of intelligent social change and reform with the hope of improving and elevating the human condition and alleviating the impact of severe social stratification. How, indeed, can important challenges surrounding medical health, psychological well-being, economic welfare, worker safety, the environment, and international relations be addressed unless trained and committed practitioners are mobilized to play a role in such endeavors? If social guardians and members of the political class are to retain the confidence of society, however, their efforts must resonate with broader segments of the public. Although much of the criticism of their role has come from conservatives and anti-statists, it is important to recognize the culturally significant sources of such discontent. Service intellectuals must succeed in lending their expertise to social problems without necessarily imposing their own needs and sensibilities upon the rest of the citizenry. Knowledge professionals must prove they can play a genuine role in reforms that curb elites, special interests, and privileged classes of all kinds, including their own. The socio-political sector must demonstrate that it can refashion itself to serve all segments of society instead of the interest groups normally aligned with its agenda. In a nation comprised of individualists as well as participants in common endeavors, the frequently cited goal of cultural pluralism takes on added meaning. Indeed, the requirements of diversity may compel socially committed intellectuals to fuse their own modernizing cultural values with the more traditional ethics of small business, the military, the religious world, ethnic subcultures, and other cohesive communities. Too often, public debate has asked ordinary Americans to choose between reliance on the goodwill of narrowly focused business interests or dependence on the judgment of socially committed intellectuals and reformers immersed in their own worlds. Although knowledge professionals and elements of the political class offer liberation from the crueler consequences of the market, they often appear tainted by self-reflexive concerns and preferences or commitment to favored protégés. Arguably, a healthy democracy needs practitioners who serve all elements of the social structure, not some. Indeed, society cries out for disinterested healers, reformers, and authors of consent, not ideological monitors or masters. If there are lessons to be learned from the debates and conflicts, they conceivably rest on the notion that even the brightest among us require a balanced perspective on the effects and legacy of our mutual endeavors. Failure to achieve such vision only can provide comfort to those elements of society whose intentions are far from benevolent. And that was The Political Class and American Democracy by David Horowitz, former and perhaps professor emeritus of history at Portland State University. And this article is excerpted from his book, America's Political Class Under Fire: The 20th Century's Great Cultural War. You've been listening to A Story Told. I'm Michael McCusker.